Our next speaker is an assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Alabama, David Beto. I think I should mention that our own Forrest McDonald is also in the Department of History at the University of Alabama, so you're in very, very fine company there, Dave. He has his PhD in American history from the University of Wisconsin. And it seems as though, as looking down through his record of writings, that he's always emphasized the voluntary aspect of things, the bubbling underneath the surface that's going on. His dissertation later became a book published by the University of North Carolina Press, and it has to do with taxpayer revolts during the Great Depression. He was a research fellow at the Earhart Foundation and Institute for Humane Studies at George Mason University. He has written a number of articles and academic papers, and he indicates that he's working right now on two works, one called From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State, Fraternal Societies and Social Welfare, 1890 to 1940. I read his paper, and I think that book would be right on and excellent reading. Also, he has a book on voluntary action in urban history called The Voluntary City, and he has some flyers here, Independent Institute flyers, that if you'd like to order a copy after reading his paper, well, you'd get one of these flyers from us right up here at the table. All right, Dave, would you like to go ahead?
On the face of it, historical study of American fraternal societies would seem to be a subject that would only be suited for connoisseurs of the arcane and the sort of irrelevant. Few Americans today have come into any contact with a fraternal lodge. And when many of us think of the lodge, we perhaps think of it first and foremost as a place from past years where television characters such as Ralph Cramden, of the Loyal Order of Raccoons, and his friend Ed Norton would go. Fred Flintstone would go to a lodge, the Loyal Order of Water Buffaloes. And there they would go. There they would escape from their more sensible wives to engage in childish hijinks. They'd wear silly hats. They'd mouth pretentious rituals. There was a time, however, when fraternal societies could not be dismissed so easily. Before the Depression, they were major neighborhood centers for mutual aid and social cooperation. About 18 million American men and women, and fraternal societies was a term that also applied to female organizations, about 18 million American men and women were members in 1920. It's a conservative estimate. That's about 30% of all adult males over the age, or adults over the age of 20. Now, what was the membership of labor unions? Well, the membership of labor unions at about this time rarely exceeded 10% of all workers. We're talking about, you know, about 30% of all Americans, yet we have endowed chairs of labor history, many, many universities. We don't have many chairs of fraternal history. If you know of any, let me know. So it's a little bit of an imbalance there, perhaps. Now, the fraternal society was basically the American version of the friendly societies, which David Green and Patricia have done research on. And by the way, in the book, The Voluntary City, which isn't out yet, should be out in the next few months, we do have a chapter in there from David Green describing the role of the British friendly societies as well. Fraternal societies were controlled by their members and organized around a decentralized lodge system. These were at the local level. Frequently, they would feature a ritual. In fact, that was standard. And the ritual would be a collection of ceremonies, special handshakes, other practices such as elaborate ceremonies, that kind of thing. Now, the major functions of the ritual were to provide entertainment, to test member solidarity, also to teach moral values as well. And the ritual was a very important part of the fraternal organization, and David Green has written much about the British societies and their rituals. The Lodge, the American Society, Fraternal Society Lodge, which had all kinds of things such as bake sales, sporting events, raffles, picnics, the Lodge was often the center of community in countless neighborhoods and cities and in small towns throughout the country. So when you talk about community at the turn of the century, you have to talk about fraternal societies, I would say, at least if you talk about community among the working class. Equally important, the fraternal society furnished members and their families with an extensive system of mutual aid for social welfare. The keystone of fraternal mutual aid was the death benefit. The death benefit was actually a form of life insurance, and it would be paid to the beneficiary of deceased members. And again, it was especially prevalent among wage earners. This is an article that describes this from 1910 from a magazine called Everybody's Magazine. And it said the following: rich men insure in the big companies to create an estate. Poor men insure in fraternal orders to create bread and meat. It is an insurance against want, the poorhouse, charity, and degradation. The size of the average fraternal death benefit in 1920 was about $1,500. That would be roughly equivalent to the average annual wage at the time, or the average annual income during the period. Now, few institutions better reflected the diversity of the American people at the beginning of the 20th century than fraternal societies. They developed among the immigrant population, among every ethnic group you could name, and they provided a number of services to the newly arrived immigrant, including temporary housing, English lessons, information on employment opportunities. They were perhaps the leading forces, the leading organized forces of assimilation, perhaps rivaled by the churches in some sense. Just some examples of immigrant societies. Poles had the Polish National Alliance. Italians could turn to the Sons of Italy. The Irish formed hundreds of chapters of the Ancient Order of Hipernians. Jews had numerous groups called Landsmannschaften, which were based on old geographical loyalties in Eastern Europe. They had socialist organizations such as the Workmen's Circle. B'nai B'rith was another organization. We look beyond European immigrants. We look at Mexican immigrants, and we find that they subscribed to so-called mutualistas, also groups called penitentes, which had a connection with the church. Chinese immigrants belonged to companies, and Japanese immigrants belonged to numerous regional associations. The popularity of the fraternal society among blacks was especially impressive. Blacks were, at the turn of the century, excluded from most of the white fraternal societies. And what they did is they formed their own organizations. And so for every leading white society, in quotes, you usually have a parallel black organization of virtually the same name. And some examples would be the Elks. You had a black version of the Elks, the Odd Fellows, the Knights of Pythias, and they changed the name a little bit. Maybe the white organization would be called the Independent Order of Odd Fellows, the black organization would be the Grand United Independent Order of Odd Fellows. The largest black society in the early 20th century was a group called the Grand United Order of Odd Fellows. In 1904, it had a membership of about 285,000 people. It had 4,000 lodges. That's one organization. It's out of a black population of about, I don't know, 10 million, something like that. Many black societies, however, did not take on the name of a white organization. And there were groups such as the True Reformers, the Knights and Daughters of Tabor, and my favorite organization, or the name is my favorite anyway, the Grand United Order of Galilean Fishermen. 1910, sociologist Howard Odom estimated that, quote, the total membership of the Negro societies, paying and non-paying, is nearly equal to the church membership. Okay? At about the same time, another sociologist named Fanny Williams wrote studies of black migrants in the North. had the following observation. She proclaimed, quote, that in nothing does the colored man live such a strenuous life as he does as a lodge man. The lodge, more than any other merely social organization, is a permanent and increasing force. Fraternal societies and other mutual aid organizations gave blacks from all economic classes access to insurance. I was amazed by these figures when I found them, but this is not a peculiar example here. It's been demonstrated to me over and over again, but let me quote from a study that was done in 1919 by the Illinois Health Insurance Commission, which, by the way, was an organization that part of the state government. They wanted to promote health insurance, government health insurance, and they did a block study of Chicago and asked people, do you own insurance? How much? And it was several thousand people. And what did they find? Well, they found that 93% of the black families in Chicago had at least one member with life insurance. 93%, all right? Much of it provided by fraternal orders. Blacks were the most highly insured group in the city in terms of other ethnic groups. They were the most likely to own insurance. They were followed by other groups, such as the Czechs. 89% of them had some life insurance. The Poles and Irish, 88%. And where do we find native whites, native-born whites? Well, impressive, but a bit lower. They're 85% own life insurance. Now, these figures are amazing on several counts. You have to remember that blacks at this time worked overwhelmingly in low-paid, unskilled occupations, domestic service, menial labor, seasonal kind of work, that sort of thing, and yet they are more likely than any other group to own insurance policies. And I think they are a striking testament to the resilience of the black family in this era, where we have Jim Crow segregation, we have extreme poverty. And people who've done research on the history of the black family, I think, should look a little bit at things like this, because they indicate something about family solidarity. These statistics that I've given you so impressed a progressive at the time. His name was Isaac Rubinow, and he was the leading advocate in the country for government health insurance. This is a very old movement. And he wrote in 1913, he singled out blacks and immigrants from Eastern Europe as, quote, groups where the habit of mutual insurance through voluntary association has developed to the highest degree in the United States. Okay? Fraternal benefits can be classified under the category of reciprocal belief, or reciprocal relief. They are a form of reciprocal relief. And by that, I'm trying to draw a contrast between fraternal benefits and those dispensed by government, and I would also say by organized charities at the turn of the century. Reciprocal belief tends to be decentralized, spontaneous, and informal. And again, the contrast to it would be what I would call, or others have called, hierarchical relief, is dispensed top-down, either privately or publicly. Now, an attribute of reciprocal relief is that the donors and the recipients often come from the same or nearly the same walks of life. So you have a situation where today's recipient could be tomorrow's donor, and vice versa. You have many examples of reciprocal belief, and historians have shown virtually no interest in these. These include help by neighbors and friends, assistance provided through family networks, assistance provided through individual church congregations. I'm not talking about national ecclesiastical organizations. I'm talking about at the church level. Very little research on this. Now, in this regard, the leaders of fraternal societies rejected the view that their benefits were in any sense charity. Typical expression of this attitude can be found in an article written in 1905 by an official of the Ladies of the Maccabees. This is the largest society, fraternal society, exclusively for women. At its height, it had about 200,000 members. And the author of this article asserted that, quote, in fraternity, there is no charity. no humiliation in accepting aid. For it is the right of the member in distress to receive that for which he or she has contributed, and the recognized duty of the other members to give. So they made a distinction between fraternity and charity, as did the British Friendly Societies. And there is a rejection here of fraternal benefits as, in any sense, open-ended entitlements, right? By the first decade of the 20th century, we see that fraternal societies are increasingly including treatment by a physician in their their menu of benefits. And this arrangement was known at the time as lodge practice. And basically, it involved a simple contract under which a doctor agreed to provide medical care to members of a lodge, usually for 1 year. And the doctor would receive in exchange a salary, and this would be determined by the size of the membership. And to become a lodge doctor, you had to win an election. So each year, the members would vote, and they'd have contests between different doctors. It's similar in some ways to a modern HMO. It becomes very extensive, and it becomes extensive, interestingly enough, among a wide array of the immigrant groups as well as blacks. To give you an example, in New Orleans in the 1920s, we know that there were 600 fraternal societies among blacks which offered the services of a doctor. And these societies had some very interesting names, such as the Ladies Friends of Faith, the Female Union Band, the Young Men of Inseparable. Based on this fixed payment system, they would lose their income and they would lose their independence. And the profession, in his words, would become demoralized and tainted by cutthroat and undignified scramble to, quote, for every doctor to, quote, sell himself to the lowest bidder. Another proponent predicted that lodge practice, if not stopped, would depress fees to levels, quote, comparable to those of the bootblack and peanut vendor. So the lodge doctor is accused of a number of different things by the medical profession. Well, lodge practice was also attacked by the profession, not only because it was bad for the doctor, but they argued it was bad for the patient who received shoddy service. In other words, was trying to get something for nothing and received poor service in return. In my view, lodge practice merits a far more favorable assessment than it has received, both from doctors at the time and from subsequent historians. And at first blush, it would seem almost impossible to defend such an argument. If you look at the surviving sources from the period, you find that almost all of them are very much opposed to lodge practice. They all turned in a verdict of guilty. Lodge practice, it was a horrible system. However, if you look more closely at a lot of these sources, you find a lot of information in them which actually casts a very positive light on lodge practice. Ironically, if you look at the journals of the medical associations, you find much in them that points to the virtues of lodge practice. And if you compare these critiques with the few defenses that do exist from the period that there were written by lodge doctors and leaders of fraternal societies, we come up with a different picture. The most important beneficiary of lodge practice was, of course, the patient of modest means. He or she was able to obtain the care of a doctor for about $2 a year. $2 a year. What is that equivalent to at the time? Well, at the time, it would be roughly equivalent to a day's wage for a laborer. If you translated that into 1995 dollars, we're talking about an annual fee that is well under $20, certainly. Now, of course, you can't exactly do these comparisons, but if you were to factor in the role of inflation. These bargain basement fees were the object of much consternation in the medical journals, as you might guess. Dr. J.W. Bolton of Warrensburg, Missouri, for example, said, he thundered, basically, quote, "The idea of a physician giving his time to a man and his family, large or small, for $2 a year, exclamation point. This is in a medical journal. Likewise, Dr. Straub Shearer of Bangor, Pennsylvania, reported a lodge member's boast that, quote, his family could be doctored cheaper than he could be shaved. And he was taken aback by this, Dr. Shearer, and he asked the member for specifics about this statement, and the member told him, quote, that he purchased a ticket from his tonsorial artist at the rate of $1 per month. This entitled him to 3 shaves per week and 1 haircut per month. He paid his physician 70 cents per month and received all medical attention as well as medicine for himself, wife, and child. So I think it's fair to say that at no time in recent memory has medical care been so readily available for the poor in American society. Well, we have a number of checks also, in addition to the process of competition, that help to ensure the care of lodge practice. To ensure the quality of care, we find that the rules of the lodges often included specific sanctions, and these were mostly in the form of fines for doctors who neglected their duties. And among the possible infractions that were specified in the rules of fraternal societies were failure to report at meetings. So a doctor could be punished for this. He had to appear at meetings and make a report on the membership, the health of the membership. Fraudulent approval of sick claims and refusal to respond to a patient's house calls. For the latter violation, both the Fraternal Order of Eagles and the Foresters authorized a lodge to hire a substitute from the open market and then deduct the charges from the salary of the delinquent doctor. So that was a pretty effective method. Now, an important consequence of lodge practice for the patient was to facilitate habits of assertiveness. And the members who used these services anticipated, I think, by several decades, the active patient, which is now very much in vogue on the Today Show and Oprah and so forth. And if you look at the medical journals, you see this all over the place. They make this very clear, so clear that one wonders why it has not elicited more comment from historians. We see examples of doctors who are very unaccustomed to this kind of treatment denouncing the readiness of patients to quibble, in their words, about the fee, the diagnosis. One doctor blamed excessive and unnecessary house calls for engendering fears in the doctor that, quote, he will lose his position if he fails to answer every call, regardless of circumstances, and his knowledge of the fact that he is being imposed on constantly by members who abuse their privileges. This is a quote from a Dr. Zierith, who I mentioned earlier, and he accused the lodge doctor of undermining, in his words, the spirit of gratitude on the part of the patient toward his physician that should exist, that the patient is always the debtor of the conscientious physician. The physician is thus placed in the same class as the tradesman. They're very worried that you're perverting the noble arts of medicine by introducing the market. Now, for the patient, if not always the doctor, lodge practice had the additional virtue of affording accessible preventive care. Again, you don't have to look any farther for evidence than the repeated accusations that we find in professional journals that doctors were always being pestered about trivial complaints. According to Dr. Zierith, the patient called on the lodge doctor at all hours of the night to, quote, see cases repeatedly where a physician would not be called were the regular fee to apply. One of the children in the family has abdominal pain, and the anxious mother promptly conjectures that it is appendicitis, when it was nothing more than too much indulgence in mince pie. But, Dr. Zierith continued, it looks stylish to have the doctor's rig standing in front of the house and excites the curiosity and envy of the neighbors. Therefore, the, quote, free doctor is summoned. I'm not loading the dice here. This is rife in medical journals during the period. By the 1920s, fraternal societies have entered a period of decline, a decline from which they have never recovered. Why? I wish I knew. I have a few ideas. I think the role of the medical associations was crucial. By 1910, the medical profession had launched all-out war against lodge practice. State medical societies had imposed manifold sanctions against doctors who accepted these contracts. And in the vanguard of the movement, you would find the local medical society. And they would launch a campaign if they had a problem with lodge practice, and it would usually follow a two-stage strategy. First, the leaders of the county medical association would request that each doctor sign an agreement to refuse lodge contracts, or at least refuse such contracts if they were under the published fee schedules of the local society, which tended to rule it out. Sometimes this would work. Sometimes you'd get a pariah who would refuse to go along. If the pariah refused to go along, he could be expelled from the association, or he could be subject to a boycott. I'll give you an example. 1913, the members of the medical society in New York vowed that if any doctor took a lodge contract, they would, quote, refuse to consult with him or assist him in any way or in any emergency whatever. In this case, these boycotts would extend to patients as well. And one method of enforcement was to pressure hospitals to close their doors to doctors and to patients of an offending lodge. So if you were seeing a lodge doctor, there are examples where they would deny care. And, okay, I'm almost done here. I think that that is certainly one factor, the role of the medical societies, helping to undermine the fraternal societies. Another factor is the rise of the welfare state, and we often focus, I think, a bit too much on the 1960s and forget that the welfare state has been growing as part of a long incremental process. And if we look at the 1920s, the 1910s, it is a time of rapid expansion of welfare spending in areas such as widows' pension, the predecessor of aid to families to dependent children, workers' compensation, and so forth. And there were many leaders of fraternal societies that were very worried about this and predicted that this would lead to a diminution of the appeal of these organizations. And I'd like to close with a quote. And this is a quote from 1917 from the magazine of the Fraternal Order of Eagles, which I think looks very prescient in retrospect. And here is what the article said. It said the following: "The state is doing or planning to do for the wage earner what our order was a pioneer in doing 18 years ago," meaning welfare and so forth. "All this is lessening the popular appeal of our beneficial features. With that appeal weakened or gone, we shall have lost a strong argument for joining the order. For no fraternity can depend entirely on its recreational features to attract members." In other words, it's saying, look, if we don't have tangible benefits to offer our members, nobody's going to want to join our organization. So I think that's a good place to end it. Thank you.
My whispering to Dave about time may have shortened that by a paragraph or two, but that I know you want to ask questions, and that prompts me again to mention that we have the flyers about his book up here, and you can get those couple of paragraphs in addition, plus a lot more detail from the book. So thank you very, very much, Dave.